Welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. My name is Anne-Marie Nichoren. The Stinging Fly has been publishing new writers and new writing for the past 28 years. We take a particular interest in promoting the short story. And for this podcast, we ask writers from the latest issue of the Stinging Fly magazine to join us in the studio to discuss their work. On this month's episode, we'll be hearing from two poets, Simon Costello and Jane Robinson, both published in the Stinging Fly issue 53, the climate issue. We'll hear Simon and Jane read from their work, as well as discuss the practice of poetry and the wider environments we as poets work in. Simon Costello is from Tullamore, County Offaly. His poetry has been published in The Poetry Review, The Stinging Fly, The London Magazine and elsewhere. He has been awarded first prize in the Patrick Cavanagh Award for Poetry 2024 and the Rialto Nature and Place Poetry Prize 2021. In 2024, his poetry chapbook Saturn Devouring was published by the Lifeboat Press. He is currently a Government of Ireland IRC scholar and PhD candidate. He teaches at the Mary Lavin Centre School of English in University College Dublin and also works for Granta magazine. He lives in Dublin. Jane Robinson is an award-winning Irish poet with a doctoral degree in biology from the California Institute of Technology. Her books are Journey to the Sleeping Whale, Salmon, 2018, and Island and Atoll, Salmon, 2023. Several of her poems have been set to music. Some recent work is published in Archipelago, Howl, Cold Mountain Review, Poetry Ireland Review, and The Stinging Fly. Jane and Simon, you're very welcome to the podcast. It's a beautiful, calm February morning here in Dublin. There's a little bit of rain in the sky, but it's also full of bright spring light. And miraculously, we seem to find ourselves in this quiet space between rainstorms and flooding. And I want to ask you both about finding shelter in these very dramatic times. Simon, is there a particular place that you return to feel grounded and connected to the possibilities of poetry?
Yeah, so like outside of the little office I have at home, which when it rains, I kind of enjoyed it because it kind of forces me to stay in and you kind of have that coziness from it. And then other times, even if it's raining, the dog needs to be walked. So he's getting walked regardless. So we're kind of in the foothills of the Dublin Mountains. So I just kind of walk him up around there. And yeah, it's just like a great way to write on the go, to kind of work things out in your head as
What's
you're moving.
What's your dog's name?
It's Bagel. He's a schnauzer. He's very yappy, but I love him.
Big shout out to Bagel and all the doggy companions that make our writing lives so comfortable.
I love it, yeah.
And what about you, Jane? Is there somewhere that you go to for shelter or refuge or harbour?
Well, again, I love to go outdoors to encounter other beings by chance, and by beings I mean in the widest sense of plants and other than human animals as well as humans. I take refuge in reference books and information, but I feel because I started maybe from the side of books that I'm very, very conscious to feel the weather on my skin and to be fully trying to embody what I write.
Oh, talk to us about reference books for a minute.
Well, I suppose I'm talking, you know, if I go outdoors, I try to remember to bring a tiny little field guide to Irish wild plants, just so that I would be able to put a name to what plants I might see. I don't always remember, but that's sort of a reference book I'm talking about.
I love those Niall McCotter books that give you the folklore and mythology
of
plants and trees. And I also do use the bird app as well. It's wonderful when you're on a walk to be able to observe, a plant or a tree and to try and look it up and see what, and even have a look at what the word might be in another language. I'm often looking up Irish language words as well. Well, I'm really looking forward to hearing both of your poems. I had the wonderful experience of working with you both on your poems. Jane, I might go to you first of all. You responded to the Song of Amargan with a piece for the issue, and would you like to say a couple of words about the Song of Amargan? I'm conscious that there might be people tuned in who don't know this foundational text that so many poets in Ireland have responded to.
Yes, so I suppose they're said to have been spoken by the Milesian poet Amargan, the sort of druid sailor leader of those people who, when he stepped his foot onto the shore in Kerry, spoke the words, I'm the wind on the sea, I'm the wave of the sea, as was in Lady Gregory's version, published more than 100 years ago.
To describe it as a text is kind of, it's almost tricky without reading it in full, but the Song of Amargan, it's almost like a chant, isn't it? A manifesto. It's a summoning of the land by Amargan, who was this Milesian mythical figure, and it's very associated with did you mention Kerry, the landsman?
I did, and there Paddy Bush, who lives in Kerry, has been working with this material for years. I think he has a published one from a response from 1999, and there's a lovely program recorded for Lyric FM called Over Nine Waves, which is a very good introduction, I think, to the Song of Amargan. It's chanted in Irish by Paddy Bush, and then there follow many responses, and ending with a response by Paula Meehan, who takes, as she describes it, the cantankerous voice of one of the Tuatha De Danann people, a woman of the people who were being invaded by the Milesians. So that's really interesting.
Apparently, Robert Graves said English poetic education should really begin not with the Canterbury Tales and not with the Odyssey, but with the Song of Amargan. And it's an amazement to me that this text is not on the syllabus in national school, or I don't think it's on any syllabus in secondary school. Were you aware of the Song of Amargan, or have
I only came into contact with it when I read Jane's poem in the issue. I hadn't heard of it before. And then when I read it, I'm going to butcher this line now, but is there a line in it? I'm the stag of seven kingdoms.
Yeah.
I think that's it. I could have that wrong now, but it's a beautiful line in the poem.
Yeah.
But that was my first introduction to it, was through Jane. I hadn't heard it before.
Yeah, it's a profoundly moving text. And well, let's hear your response. No,
after all that, I feel I have taken liberties with the text. But I think it's a way of voicing for today how a woman stepping onto the land and seeing everything would feel. Song for today, after the Song of Amargan from the Book of Leinster. Am woman leaning her weight on the onshore wind, am wave lipping over the sea wall, am the roar of a North Atlantic storm. Was a hind in the wide oak forest who gave birth to a giant with phosphorescent lichens drifting from his antler tines, was the mother of the great Irish elk, Megaloceros giganteus, now extinct. Am a lone sea eagle troubled by gulls on the outermost rock, am Pandion helietus reintroduced after 200 years of absence, am a dewdrop sparkling in the early morning web. Was pheasant's eye, corn cockle, purple sedge and rannoch rush, was sore wort, corn chamomile, shepherd's needle and sea stock, was a club sedge at the edge of Ireland, was scaly buckler, fern and gone. Was a fierce wild sow hunted to extinction, reintroduction of sus scrofa has been forbidden. Was Salmo Salar wending up river for my seventh spawning, heavy with wisdom from world's ocean in a time before factory ships and caged salmon. I'm clouded lake. I'm person who wanders the mountainside with pockets full of acorns. I'm a dreamer dreaming the future. I'm not a wielder of weapons. Who studies the sea creatures embedded in these limestone hills? Who feels the moon's pull in their body? From where may we watch the setting sun roll down a mountainside? Who seeks mythic cattle grazing seagrass on the seafloor's rolling meadows? Who writes love letters to the lost sea cow? Tetra, they say, might have been an ancient sea god. Now is not a time for satire. Turn out the blazing lights and still the engines. Go barefoot now, in the sea and on the shoulder of the hill.
Thank you for that reading. It's so hypnotic, isn't it? It seems to stop time for a second, and it's like this magical sphere opens up in space. It's gorgeous. There's so many moments in that poem, Jane, that stand out for me. But that line, I'm a dreamer dreaming the future, I can hear that in conversation with the original text as well. And you're also a scientist. I'm just fascinated by the conversation between this world of science and poetry. Can you talk to us a little bit about what it's like to have a foot in both of those worlds, and how those two things came into conversation with each other for this piece?
Well, in this piece, and so I omitted to, you know, give all the background explanations of the animals and plants, but you probably have realised that most of the animals mentioned are extinct in Ireland, and the great Irish elk, sadly extinct all over the world. And, you know, I think this is really relevant for the climate issue, because it was likely this huge, bigger, you know, more than twice as big as the red deer, was driven extinct probably by human predation, or else by environmental adjustments brought on by human habitation. So it was after people landed in the country.
It's just devastating, isn't it, to think of these creatures disappeared from our, and disappearing from our imaginations as well, you know.
Yes, and from our, so, you know, Amargan famously identifies with the stag of seven tines, or as Lady Gregory had it, the bull of seven battles. You know, there are many versions out there. That stag of seven tines perhaps doesn't exist anymore. How can we inhabit the soul of the animal that maybe is our, you know, our spiritual animal, if it's not here anymore?
Like, what is it about the stag that we feel so close to? I think the deer, like those creatures, they have been companions to us for so long, not just in our everyday lives, but in our poetry and stories and our oldest myths. Like, what's your relationship to the stag, and what place does it hold in your imagination?
I suppose it's kind of, if I imagine very hard and I try to take on, you know, a cloak from an older poet who was around when these animals were still roaming the countryside, then I feel a sort of a positive identification, you know, and maybe I would be the mother of that stag as a woman. But I suppose when I go to see the coldness of the beautiful specimens of the, you know, the skeletons of the great Irish elk that are in the Trinity College Geology Museum, there's a male and a female, and they're really iconic skeletons. But, and I actually thought I was going to be early today, so I popped in to say hello. And I felt this utter kind of gloom, you know, at their, I wasn't able to talk to them. They're, you know, that their souls have departed from that building anyway.
And oh yes, the gloom of going to see animals in a museum. I mean, it feels kind of despairing sometimes, doesn't it? Looking through a glass panel and seeing the remnants of a creature that we used to be in relationship with.
It's like that line, and it was a Heaney's Bogland where he calls the skeleton of a stag, like put up as a, he called it a full crate of air. It's just like, I think it captures that kind of empty, gloomy feeling of seeing it and it being in that liminal space where this was alive, but it's not anymore, but the histories of it is ever present.
Mm. But on the other hand, the, you know, the actual physical evidence and the study of this, you know, the anatomy of the animal, I think is really, really important. And all the information and the background data, physical data you can get from that, I think is, you know, that's maybe in a different space than the sort of the soul feeling of this mm-hmm. animal.
I sometimes think of poems as discoveries and every poem being a discovery of sorts. And did you have the experience with this poem of discovering something unexpected?
Yes, I think so. That I discovered that taking on the power of a chant, of a song that is from a long ago and a powerful one, could help me to, in my goal, which is really to speak truth to power and to, you know, to talk about the problems, but under the cloak of an old Druid poet, it felt as if I was giving myself permission to say things that I might have been hesitant to unable to
express. The cloak of the Druid poets. How nice is that?
I just wanted to say something else, which is that, you know, it's a foundational poem in Ireland, but Monaghan McGann had spoken a bit about how Krishna, who is an incarnation of Vishnu, spoke similar words to Amargin's song and as recorded in the Bhagavad Gita. Mm. So this is a very ancient, you know, way of looking at things.
And these ancient texts, they connect us into this real web of storytelling that runs across cultures.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Simon, do you draw from other worlds when you're writing poetry? Jane mentioned reference books and the world of science, and I'm curious about your process and the different influences that you bring to your poetry.
Yeah, I think like especially when I sit down to write a poem, like there's always kind of a political intuition or kind of an instinct that I want to explore. So like a lot of texts I'd read, especially from my studies, it'd be critical theory, any books that engage with kind of eco-communism. But I find that I can't enter into the space, and maybe this is my lack of skill, I can't enter into the space and just follow that with that as the banner. So I kind of, the way I would do it is like, for instance, like when I wrote Bog Elegy, I was reading a lot of reports on kind of carbon emissions from the bogs, but then also the flip side of data centers. And so that was kind of what I wanted to do, was to talk about that tension. And I found that when I sat down to do it with that information, I couldn't, because it just became like overly didactic. So I kind of like to do this thing that I think John Gardner uses as an exercise in The Art of Fiction, where he asks somebody to write as a older person describing a barn. And their son has just died in a war, and you have that knowledge, but you're asked in the exercise, do not reference the son, the death, or the war. So you're pre-primed with that information. And I get my students to do it, and you'll find that it will articulate itself, even if it's not explicitly mentioned. So that's kind of how I do it. Maybe if I was more skilled, I'd figure out a way to kind of do it more explicitly, but yeah.
Oh no, that really resonates with me, the idea that we go towards the poem and and the discovery and the transformative element of it, and it will carry the ghost of all the research and the reading and the influence. None of that is lost, but sometimes it doesn't belong explicitly inside the poem. Would you like to read Bog Elegy for us?
Yeah, of course, yeah. Aye, a grand stretch in the evening for it. To foot the turf into piles thick as flies and send the house to the other side of winter. This place is given farewell party on the brink, given wellies squelching slime and the sods looking damp and smackable. Like kids in a cloud, I bend my lips to the chimney and take a drag of that distant cottage. Were I the world, I'd undo my belt and hang it at the end of the horizon. Rob, if you're anything, it's tender evidence rotten in another direction. A shrub of boxwood, perfume and haunts of cat piss in the air. I can't make heads or tails of any of this, and you've only given me one death. Rob, I know everyone's getting sick of bog elegies, of thirsting for strangers below the boots. You know as well as I do, if I keep flipping this poem's landscape upside down, it'll confide in me its smother of ancient whores, its tapestry of bronze ambassadors leathering in the mucky collage. Rob, did you ever get what was coming? Am I getting exactly what you asked for? I drive the trailer past the bedsit we drank in, and when the paramedic presses her ear to your chest, does she hear that ticking clock of ancient butter? Rob, must I sprout petals from the drain like gangs of teeth? Pal, steady on. You're spilling fuel all over the gaff, and what I've give to have never met you would fill a septic tank. And sure, it's grand. Sure, every day above the dirt is to get farther than was meant. Is fighting the urge to climb down into the lake I know is buried beneath here. And come to think of it, you never cried in front of me, and it feels like an alt-right conspiracy. One where I succumb to the sexuality of frogs and October trees wait to drop their orange comments on your grave. And didn't you get kicked out of the chat for texting Ireland's a parent crouched over a drain, watching their child translate into a country? Did you pass that off as your own? Did I ever tell you you're a bit of a chancer, a bastard? Rob, did I not tell you I loved you? I shove my hands between the crevices of the turf and false widows spin the fossil of a glove. A handshake to see which of us can crush the other into a purer gram of man. Rob, I don't think your kid misses you and mine keeps asking not to be born. Not till you come back from your cabin on Mars to pour into your boot prints. Till we wade through this bog's huzzah of bramble and find a burnt out Audi buffering down some boony lane, just letting the whole forest inside it.
Gosh, you've really reminded me of why it is we love hearing poets read their own work. Because hearing you read that poem, I'm already such an admirer of the poem. And when it came in as a submission, I just knew immediately we needed to have this piece in the climate issue. But hearing you read it, I hear a whole other dimension now to it as well. And I wonder, what kind of relationship do you both have to reading your work aloud? Is it daunting? Is it an opportunity to share something more of the poem?
I'm pretty socially anxious. I get anxious reading, and then I've been told sometimes it comes off as like really aggressive, but I don't mean it that way. It's just I'm trying to power through it. But
I don't hear aggression at all. I hear this wonderful wildness that comes through in your voice.
Oh, that's good. It's mostly nerves, I think, that fuels it. But I do find it quite difficult to read in public, and but I think I'm getting a bit better at doing it. But I find that it's probably the anxiety as well. But I'm injecting a lot of energy into it to try and kind of keep myself moving through it. So I don't know if that's the healthiest relationship to have with reading, but it's what works for me at the moment.
I used to be a chronically shy person, and I really discovered through reading poetry aloud a different kind of confidence in myself. For me, the space of reading poetry is often very calm, and it's a space where I can be myself, actually. And it is sometimes like the audience falls away or collapses and I go into my own. Is that, you're kind of nodding, Jane, is that something that you...
Well, I would agree. I find it very difficult to speak extempore sort of in a conversation in public, but when I settle into the words that I've written for the page, I feel much more comfortable because I do sound them out while I'm writing as well. And so I enjoy putting my tongue around the sounds. This poem, you asked what this writing, this poem taught me, reading it, preparing to read it taught me something because my tongue kept trying to say reintroduction of Sus Scrofa, who's the wild boar, has been forgiven, and the text says forbidden, and I had to repeat about 10 times before I could persuade myself that I should utter forbidden. And I feel as if, okay, well, maybe I should have just gone with the flow and said has been forgiven in the future. You know, maybe these wild boars will be reintroduced.
Sometimes the ear can be a sharper editor than the eye. Isn't that true?
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Like with Jane's poem, it really reminded me of, and it's very much your own, but I love that it reminded me a lot of like Whitman. It's like when you mentioned earlier about the lines, because when I read it out loud, it has that kind of expansive like broadcast and it has that catalogue rhetoric. It's that listing, but then it's very much your own and it's steeped in Ireland. And then hearing you read it, like you said, it adds a totally different dimension to it.
Like Jane, your poem, Simon, it draws from rooted tradition. Like it's impossible to talk about the bog or writing the bog without stirring ghosts. And even listeners who are not big readers of poetry will associate bog poetry with Seamus Heaney, for example. Yeah. And can you talk a bit about the challenges and also the responsibilities of writing with these giants at our shoulders?
Yeah. I was thinking about this today. I remember years ago, I was probably in my late 20s and I just started to write. And I remember, and I can't remember the poet's name, but I remember I read, it was a quote on a website from a poet and they were kind of decrying the kind of pastoral Heaney nature kind of landscape poetry. And I can kind of remember the quote, but it was something, it was trying to move Irish poetry away from kind of bog and pastoral poetry. And it was something like, it needs to be more in the urban centres. The bog is in where great sea changes are taking place. And I really hung on to that quote for like a very long time. Because I thought, yeah, no, there's enough like poetry about nature. Like we need to move it into the urban centres. And I think the complete opposite now. But especially with writing this, like a lot of poems have been written on the bog. I mean, Seamus Heaney wrote like a number of poems about it. So I think what I wanted, I knew it was, I don't want to say risky, but like I sort of knew that there it has been done before and there's been a kind of an aesthetic precedent set by it. So if I'm going to do it, I would do it as in it would possibly be the last poem I would write about the bog. And so that was kind of my way of, like Jane's, like giving myself permission and taking pressure off me. Like, I'll do this and I'll do this one time.
Mm-hmm. I was delighted to see this poem come in because I think sometimes when we're talking about craft in poetry, we are so often talking about intellectual craft. Mm-hmm. But when I look to the history of craft in this country, it is things like being on the bog, learning to work collectively, learning to follow a step-by-step process to make something. Or I think of, you know, my mother who knit orange jumpers and all of that craft is, I think, also really relevant to the task of making a poem. And I remember those summers of being on the bog. Of course, I hated being on the bog. But, you know, it was, you were often getting bit all over and getting sunburnt. But it taught me a lot that I think I later brought into my poetry life as well, of following these different steps, of being patient, of working alongside other people, and the hope involved as well, and that everything's going to turn out the right way as well.
Yeah, it's like poetry, it's inherited knowledge, it's an inherited practice. You're learning how to foot turf, how to stack it properly, checking the ground for moisture, seeing if it's even possible to foot it. And the same with poetry.
You're working in collaboration with other people. Yeah. You know, you're doing it as part of a group. and everyone has to kind of, everyone has their role and their task, and you're depending on your community. And sometimes that is also the case when you're writing a poem as well. It's more collaborative than gets talked about. The other thing that I greatly admired about the poem, this poem, is the wild tone. And I thought that, you know, it really harks back to this tradition of mourning in an Irish context. And I'm thinking in particular of the tradition of keening, which historically has not just given us space to mourn in a behaved or polite way, but to be like angry and outraged and disappointed and questioning in our grief, and to be a bit wild. And I'm wondering, were you consciously thinking of that when you were writing this poem? Were you looking to that influence, or was it anywhere in your mind at all?
Yeah, there's a vinyl record I have at home. I bought it it could be a year or so ago now, but it was one of the members of Lancome, and he's brought together all this archive of keening and like Shano singing, and some of the songs on it are like very, very old. So that was something I was kind of listening to. And that kind of Shanos and keening like was definitely an influence on writing it, absolutely.
I mean, the keening tradition is so interesting. Like these keening women who had come in and embody grief and sometimes get up on top of the coffin and bang it and berate the person who died. And, it has made me, reading about the keening tradition has really made me reflect on how polite our keening has become, but not in your poem, because you're questioning, you're in a very kind of wild conversation. And I loved the spirit of it. And just to turn to you, Jane, for a second, this idea of giants at our shoulders and history and the weight of tradition. I know that's something that you were thinking about with this poem. And how did you give yourself permission to respond to the song Vammergan?
I suppose I'm trying to get sort of beyond the current tradition and beyond, let's say, the big monotheistic religions, back to pre-Christian times. And so anything that helps me travel back in my utterances, I think, is very valuable. And although I felt quite diffident about putting it forward, since so many distinguished living poets have written from the Song of Amargan, for me, it felt quite useful in taking me in another direction, and you know, I would aspire to go further back. I kind of really admire some of the poems in this issue. For example, there's one from Beth Piatote. Is that how you pronounce her name?
That's it, Beth.
Yeah,
Piatote.
Yeah, yeah. Where you know, it's an ancestral song that pays attention to the salmon and the sturgeon. So our ancestors knew ocean. Lived among the mountains before ocean moved away. And that's, you know, a geological time that they're talking about. And I feel, you know, I think it's important in this time of worry and total destructive forces to somehow try to find our way back to voices that speak of generations before and generations to come. And the Irish language as well, poems.
I was very excited by that piece by Beth. I mean, some reports are estimating that every 40 days a language dies, and it's just catastrophic for our knowledge of land and all the wisdom contained within a language, and the perspective to have that disappearing is really, really heartbreaking. And so I thought it was important that we have this piece, which moves between an Indigenous language and the English language. And I'm glad that particularly stood out to you. And you were also very drawn to some of the Irish language.
Yeah, poems, I mean, so many poems in a bunch in the middle of the volume, and the Irish language poems, and in particular Katie Ní Baldún's, you know, very bleak, but the sea witch's incantation. For me, reading this issue is exciting because it takes this is an imaginative approach to the problems that we are all conscious of at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I was guided in my selections by the ideas of Simon Armitage. He said, you know, if you're spellbound and full of wonder, then you're less likely to want to destroy something. And I kind of brought that lens to the selections process, trying to find poets who were spellbound and very close to the wonder or the awe of a subject.
There's a lovely poem by Zoe Brigley where she sort of manages to inhabit a kind of half woman, half deer.
Yes.
I thought that was amazing. And then the moss poem I found really comforting.
Yes.
Because I feel as if moss is going to be there as long as it continues to rain. We don't need to write an elegy for moss, I hope, quite yet.
What about you? Were there other pieces in the issue that resonated with you?
Yeah, the Simon of Waylon poem, Aisling. I think the first experience I had with hearing Irish poetry live was with you at UCD when you did the event a couple of weeks or months back. And that was my first time to hear it. And I can't speak Irish.
Yeah.
I can read and pronounce some words. But
we did a bilingual event with Lisha Nichostela. Yeah. And Lisha read her Irish language poems. And we also read the translations. And then we had a bilingual conversation. Actually, Lisha has been a featured poet as well in one of the issues. And I remember you saying at that event that that you really enjoyed it. And that was your first time of hearing Irish language poetry read aloud.
That was my first time. And like I said, I can't understand it. I can read it and pronounce words, but sometimes I don't know what I'm reading. I might recognize a word here and there. But that was kind of, I loved that event. And especially the experience of reading of Waylon's poem was to read it in Irish and to be disconnected in terms of in my relationship to the text of it. There's obviously a barrier there, but obviously the other side of it is that it's a language that I can't speak it, unfortunately, but I do feel a connection to it, so I can
that
read
it. It's so amazing to me that you're not a speaker of the language, because I feel when I'm reading your poetry that there is an earthiness and a rootedness and a worldview that is very Gaela. You know, there's a wildness in your English language poetry that it seems to be carrying something of the Irish language poetry tradition in it. Have you been aware of that at all? Or do you feel that to yourself in the poems when you're writing, that there's something of that coming through?
Yeah, I think probably recently. I'm probably not aware of the it could probably because I'd be very interested in like Shannon singing. It's just recently. It's not something I've listened to for very long. But that kind of like, I come from rural Ireland, so that's where I'm very connected to. And I try, and like when people talk about style and what do they mean by that, like in terms of word choice, diction, syntax, a lot of it is infused by just how we speak in and how like Hiberno English inflects or kind of transforms the way we speak English, and then that kind of bleeds its way in. But yeah,
we all have experience of working with the Midland Bogs as well. We have discovered in our preamble chats to this podcast how strange is that that we let's talk about that for a moment. I was commissioned a few years ago by a composer called Anne Clear to spend time on the Bura Bog. Yeah. And spent many long days out there, very sunny days as I recall, writing a kind of lament for somebody on those bogs. And they're a magical place, aren't they? It's like stepping into some other kind of world. And you know, I often feel plugged in when I'm in a place like that, like fully plugged in a way that I sometimes don't in an urban environment. Jane, would you like to tell us about your experience of working with the Midland bugs?
Well, so I suppose I very consciously kind of try to turn my practice looking inwards to the centre of the country and to the places where there is still darkness and still a sort of wilderness of some kind. And I encountered the photographer Tina Claffey, who takes macro lens photographs of plants and little animals in the bogs. And she lives in County Offaly near the Killon Bog. So she took me there to, you know, looking at things with a hand lens. And I find her, I find sort of taking a different view is very inspiring for me to be able to write, because it's not just from, it's not just from sort of book knowledge, and it's not from, you know, repeated, let's say, encounters where you don't see in right detail. So for me, those were a good starting point.
So what kind of detail, you know, were you drawn to when you're...
I suppose a visual detail would just spark off my imagination, mm-hmm. and a visual detail that you might not see with the naked eye. So something you see through a hand lens where they're, you know, suddenly you see that the sticky drops on the carnivorous sundew plant that traps insects in the bog, mm. because there's so little nitrogen there. So that the sundew, you know, is a carnivore on passing midges to, mm-hmm. to get some nutrients. So those little droplets of sticky trap are suddenly sprung into focus if you look with a hand lens, which is quite exciting, do you know, mm-hmm. rather than just looking down at the ground and saying there's a sundew. Mm-hmm. So I suppose what I was trying to do in this project is to sort of to celebrate the biodiversity by looking in detail. And, you know, these, again, this would be not so worrying a biodiversity in the sense that, you know, it's unlikely, hopefully, again, I should not speak to, you know, wrongly, but as long as there is sphagnum moss and wetlands, there probably will be sundews catching the midges, and there probably will be midges. So, and then there are also plants and animals that can recover quite quickly, like insects, for example.
There's something very calming as well about looking at a thing in detail through a poetry lens, or at least there is for me.
Yes.
I can fret about what's happening with the bogs and worry myself to death and become quite emotional about what's happening, the land. And then the best way to counter that is to put on some boots, take the dog and get outside and spend time in it and realize that as we're worrying and despite everything that we're doing, you know, things are still quietly happening and the land is going about its business and trying its best to thrive.
Mm. Though the contrasts are stark between, you know, where the land was handworked by communities, you know, taking, drying the turf, and then on the other side of the fence where, you know, the machines came in from Bord na Mona and flattened everything.
Yeah.
I'm sure you could speak to that contrast.
Yeah, I think we were talking about this yesterday, but like my parents work on the bog the past, like, oh, I think they've been on it like, oh, and I guess like maybe just under 10 years now. So I would have done a couple of summers with them. Although I can hear my mates back in Tullamore being like, oh, you never did a day. But I haven't done as long as they've been doing it since they were kids. I probably only got to do it the last couple of years.
Well, it's a thing to do. It's you yourself have to run down your experience of the bog, or somebody else has to run it down. But nobody can be proud.
No.
If you're too proud being on the bog, then you're just seen as a...
Yeah, if you haven't, I suppose like you need to do a day on the bog. And if you haven't, it's not enough. But... yeah, and then we were talking earlier, but I said about like there's like a lot of tension, and I think with the poem Bog Elegy, it wasn't necessarily an elegy to the bog itself, because that biodiversity will be there, that landscape will be there, but more so the act of working it. Like my family works on it; they live in Ballinagar, just outside Tullamore, and it's self sufficiency for people, but they're also being told that they can't or shouldn't be using it anymore, but you know these are old houses they live in, so they're not facilitated by air pumps, and it's that kind of we understand it's bad and what it does to extract from the bog, but at the same time, there's not really an alternative being given for them. So it's that capitalist logic of, you know, we're not using the bog, but we're also going to allow it to be occupied by data centers. So at the same time, it's and that logic goes back to, or that extractive logic is, you know, you're not burning down your house the right way, but we're going to do a better way to do it. You know, so it's that kind of tension that exists in a, especially for a lot of people now, which I think work in bogs is becoming quite a minority for a lot of people.
And perhaps people who haven't worked on bogs, they think, oh, it's merely gathering turf and it's a fuel issue. But for people who have worked on the bogs for decades, or, you know, their families have worked there, it's a whole way of life and being in relationship with place and community, and there's a whole culture around it that
people come alive from at that time of year.
Absolutely. And it's reciprocal, you know, your neighbors help you or your family member helps you, and it's a way of being together as well. And when, as you said, when that is lost, then what comes in to fill that space?
And you're in danger of losing the associated crafts as well. That, for example, the growing the willows, the sallies, and making the baskets to carry the turf. And, you know, that would have also increased biodiversity because of all the amazing caterpillars that would graze on the willow leaves and the great amount of early blossom there.
And it was a kind of self-teaching as well. I mean, as kids, that's how you learn to name places, by being in it and being in relationship with it. And, you know, I think of my nieces now who have never been on the bog, and
never. That's all we did when we were kids.
They've never boiled an egg in a pot and drank tea with bits of heather in it and got bitten all over. Simon, I wanted to talk to you a bit about the shape of your poem on the page, because it's in this long oblong shape with corners, and I was very intrigued by it and by this boxy form. I think it's perfect for the poem, but I want you to talk about how you arrived at this decision to organize this bog poem into this shape.
It definitely didn't start like that. I think I wrote it in quite like long expansive lines, and then as it went on, I kind of became more concerned about what sort of shape or how I was going to format it. And then I kind of went back to that old mantra of like, form is never more than an extension of content. So I decided that, you know, maybe I'll give it a concrete shape. And so I decided, although I suppose on the page it looks vertical, but that stretched out horizontal landscape of the bog, that I would try and like infuse that in it as well. I think originally what I was going to do was to kind of break it up every four lines to do these drains. So I could, because I used to drain jump a lot when I was a kid. But I decided that it would be like horizontal across the page, like a bog, which is generally quite flat for most of it. And then also would look like a sod of turf in a very simple way. Yeah.
And it looks like the kind of spade that you use to cut turf.
I didn't even think of that.
I think it's the perfect shape. It can take a while, can't it, to discover what form a poem belongs in. Am I right in thinking, Jane, that the first version of your poem that you sent, the lines were they shorter? Or can you talk about the transition from the poem that you submitted and then the poem that we published?
So I have written sort of rejigged this in so many versions that I actually don't remember which one I sent you first. But I did have it sort of tightly without any stanza breaks at some point. And then when you kindly ask for more poems, for me to send you more, I had a very expanded version with in which, you know, I went more into the animals, the extinct animals. And there was one key change in the editing that I think has improved it greatly, where the final line is now, go barefoot now. And I think that strengthens it.
And there weren't, I don't think there were any fundamental changes that came out in the editing of your poems. They were both really already arrived into themselves. What there were editing conversations and there were small shifts and changes. And how did you find that experience of working with somebody who has ideas about your poem? And I mean, from my end, it was such a joy working with you both because each of you, you knew your own poems. So I knew that you were confident to hang on to your own poems, but you're both remarkably open as well and interested in how I read the poem. And I wanted to kind of find out from your side, like, what is it like to have somebody come to your poem and want to trim or move or reimagine lines?
I think for a long time I've been wanting for an editor to bounce back and forth with on my work, because I tend to be quite indecisive. You know, I'd say, oh, well, now here it is. And then I would do another draft and another draft. And, you know, if you're bouncing drafts back and forth off yourself or off your long-term friends who know your work anyway, there's sometimes a feeling that, oh, have I quite made this poem the best it could be? And so for me, it was really enjoyable to do that. And also particularly with this poem, which was from the early medieval Irish, I felt very happy that you as a Gaelgor had taken it, because that was part of my diffidence about this poem, to inhabit, to make a version, because I only have school Irish, sadly. You know, my mother didn't send me to the Gaeltacht.
It's a common thing that I hear poets being hungry for the input of editors, and it's something I really enjoy as well, is bringing my poem to somebody who has strong ideas. I love that. You know, I often feel hungry for that. So, and from your side, Simon, I think we looked to the end of your poem and we had some conversations back and forth about the last line and where the poem should end.
Similar to Jane, like I'm just, when it comes to like collaborating with an editor, because it is a collaborative process, like I'm not fucking precious about making changes or alterations, or like I'm bringing it to a magazine, and obviously like I think you have to understand that there's going to be questions and suggestions. And I think for this poem, yeah, I think it was the last line. I think there was like, it was just a certain word switch or change that needed to happen. And we kind of went back and forth about it. And then I think we found it, which was a little bit more of a stripped back version. But I was really happy with it. I loved working with you. It was brilliant.
It was a pleasure to work with you both. I mean, it's one of the excitements of working with the Stinging Flies, getting to meet poets and, you know, have chats about the poems and the context and the worlds of the poems. So from my end, really, really exciting to work with you both. You know, you both have busy lives and other things that you do apart from write poetry, and you've both been involved or are involved with the world of academia. Simon, you work at UCD presently. And Jane, you have done a PhD, and you talked about going to LA to do your PhD and the eco shock that you experienced there. But maybe you'd each talk for a little bit about poetry and the world of academia and the richness of that, and maybe also the challenge and the tensions of that as well.
So for me, it's quite a tension, I think, because I kind of went impulsively off to LA freshly out of degree in Trinity College, long time ago, longer ago than I would care to say, and I was sort of tracked automatically down the sort of academic route of science and doing a PhD in biology, which was, you know, experimental biology, but the utter ecological shock of landing up in an LA, I'm very homesick as well, and just, you know, car city, and it was full of smog at that time, having grown up in sort of the very outskirts of Dublin where it was quiet and natural seeming.
Oh, when you said eco shock, I was transported back to the age of 18, coming from Donegal on the John McGinley bus, arriving at DCU and feeling like a goat in a supermarket, like, you know, like so out of place. And just, you know, I just couldn't even find myself a way around the buildings. It was eco shock, you know, coming out of the mountains and into this constructed environment.
And I think that's something, you know, I wouldn't have had the word for back then. It was completely difficult. It was difficult. And I suppose that started me on a path of reading, you know, kind of trying to argue that this was not right, what had happened. You know, the original natural vegetation had been stripped away, first by settlers who had planted their orange groves, and then once again those were stripped away for the enormous highways. And I could go on a long time.
I mean, I was amazed at last year when I was writing residence in UCD at how alive and vibrant the campus is. Yeah. With, I mean, you have the beautiful lakes there, the swans, the ducks. There are the Earth Institute do tours every week, and I learned so much about the wildflowers. Like, as a campus, I was so impressed by the sensitivity to the natural world.
Yeah, I love it there. Like, I'm quite new to academia, so like I failed my leaving cert, and then I came back as a mature student, and my master's that I did it by distance. So starting my PhD back in 2022, and I hopefully will be finished this year. That's kind of like my first time. So I feel that, like we were talking about tension, but that tension between being a writer, but then also new to academia, and like academia kind of sometimes looking for argument and legibility, and then also the idea of writing about practical things, especially like with this poem, and then trying to look at that through the lens of academia. But it does work, and like it gives you space. It gives you space to examine things. And with UCD, like it's very eco-focused. Like there's a group that I'm a part of, although they do far more work than I do, with friends Robin and Romeo, and they were part of the eco-communist group. And there's a great sensitivity to that in UCD. And I mean, like you said, even walking around, you're just squirrels just bulleting everywhere. And it's lovely to be on. Yeah, it's a lovely campus.
Yeah, I have such a beautiful memory of last spring there, and getting a bird tour by somebody from the Earth Institute, and thinking, gosh, there's a vibrancy out here, and people really looking to the natural world. It was a beautiful place to write, actually. And the cherry blossom trees
lovely,
as well,
yeah,
coming
yeah.
down.
Yeah.
And I thought, God, what a lovely thing to do, to bring poetry students underneath the cherry blossom trees. And
that's
something
that's encouraged, like the Mary Lavin Centre for Writing. Like we're often told, like, I probably need to do it now with my students, because they'll probably, if they're listening, they'll be like, he never did that. But a lot of other better probably tutors than me will often just take the classes out to write outside in spring when it gets a bit better, and they can just kind of absorb it and respond to it actively as they're outside. So yeah,
you mentioned there failing your leaving cert. I'm imagining that puts you in a really good place now to tutor and mentor students over difficult hurdles. Does it?
Yeah, I think especially, like, I get a lot of mature students that come in, like, and they could be coming from all different backgrounds. So I've a lot of, I'm probably like jealous of my students sometimes, because I'm like seeing them, like they're young, they're like 18, 19, and you can see, and I often say to them like, oh guys, this is so cool. Like you're coming to like read books and write poetry, and like, I'm probably living a bit vicariously through them. But yeah, I do get students from, just they would have missed out on education their entire lives. They're, some of them are on pensions and they're coming back to study. And you get to work with them, and sometimes it's their first chance. I remember I had one student, and he would have left school around his junior cert, and he came back in, I think he was in his 70s, and he came back to do an undergrad in English, And it was a pleasure to have him. But yeah, I do find I've maybe a bit of more of an inclination of how to kind of approach them to kind of like find the right back door for them to enter into the subject. Yeah.
But so much of writing poetry is allowing yourself to fail and, and picking yourself back up again and coming at the poem a second, a third time, a 50th time. And do you each have strategies or ways of overcoming hurdles in a poem? Like, what's your go-to if you feel a draft of a poem is not coming out how you want it to? Like, what do you do next? What tools are at your disposal, Jane?
I suppose putting it through a sequence of drafts, and as I said earlier, I think I do that too much. I tend to confuse myself with so many alternative drafts, but
which is also a strategy. Confusing yourself,
yes,
is also
exactly
a legitimate way of dealing with the poem that's not doing what you want it to do.
Yes, and I suppose also sort of trying to aim as high as possible, to be as ambitious as possible for each poem, and on the one hand, and then on the other hand is, well, each poem is a new start, and if it doesn't work, it's fine. Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because if you know, I feel as if I'm always circling around a sort of a problem and taking different angles of points of view. I find quite exciting, actually.
So you have to hold those two ideas in mind. You have to be as ambitious as possible for the poem, and then you also have to hold that idea that if it doesn't work, it's fine.
Yes.
As well.
Yeah.
And they're almost two competing things, but you have to be open to both of those.
Yes, I find it comforting, actually, that they're competing. It kind of speaks, I think, to maybe the scattiness of my practice, really.
Well, what about you, Simon? Do you have ways of overcoming failure or transforming failure in a poem? Like, what do you turn to in terms of being able to deal with that?
Yeah, probably Charles Simic, because he has this collection of prose essays called, I can't remember the name of it, but the name of the actual specific essay is Venus of the Little Eskimos. And he talks about being open to chance. And I read this like maybe 2 years ago, and I've just like, it's like that essay is like my little Bible now that I go to when I'm struggling. And he just talks about taking random fragments out of books, not in like a plagiarism way, but like taking like random words, putting them down on the page and being very like open to chance. And then kind of taking these like fragmented bits and pieces that kind of scatty in a way, and then bringing them to what he calls the house of correction called sense, when you then start to kind of apply them to a poem. And that's an exercise I go back to constantly, either to start a complete poem or if I'm struggling somewhere through and I need to find something. That honestly works for me quite a lot. So I'd recommend that essay to anybody.
That's wonderful advice as well, to be open to chance. And I think that's why so many of a poet's, you know, recommend getting out and engaging with the natural world and, you know, become stilled into advice like go for a walk. But what we really mean when we talk about going for a walk is being open to chance and open to something a little bit of unexpected crossing our paths. What are you excited about in terms of poetry today? What poetry and the future, what are you looking towards that you're excited about? What's energizing you? What's giving you a lift on the low days of doom and gloom when we're looking at this world in crisis? what's giving you hope, if that's not too big a word?
in terms of like what I'm reading?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of like poetry, like newer poetry that's been kind of written and published. It's not that it hasn't existed in it before, but it has that political inclination and that sensitivity to ecology. And, you know, people are angry, young writers or any writers are angry, and you can see that being infused into the work. So that I find really, really exciting. And then especially in Ireland, like we've lots of students coming through the Mary Lavin Centre that are kind of very much doing that sort of thing. And it's really encouraging to see. And then, I mean, you've got some great poets like Molly Twomey, Dean Brown, Kelly Michaels. Like you've got a lot of these, Gustav Parker Hibbett. You've got all these amazing new poets on the island that are just writing just really transformative work with a keen sense of image. And it's just really exciting. You could just eat it up all day.
It is exciting to see the next generation of poets be at one and, you know, have the confidence to be outraged, yeah, and to be furious, and that they have that gumption and energy. It gives me hope, actually, that there is a community around this fight for climate justice as well. What about you, Jane? Are there particular poets that you're reading or traditions that you're looking to that, you know, are giving you a lift?
I suppose I'm always returned to the chance encounters with the natural world. And you said that so beautifully. And, you know, just to be able to step outside and meet a jackdaw or a seagull flying overhead, I think is a great gift in times of trouble. And a long may that last. You know, I feel as if anybody who's able to sort of express a different imaginative reality and very many diverse imaginative realities and all the voices working together and separately, I think that's really important for these times when, you know, it's all, it seems like all the troubles are coming about because of massive corporations and massive violent movements doing violence against the earth and against all the inhabitants, people and other communities, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think all the efforts of speaking in endangered languages, of trying to get beyond human discourse in whatever way to, you know, to sort of imagine oneself as a plant or a river or...
Mm. Thank you both for such wonderful insights into your poems and your practices. And I'm so glad that you're both writing and publishing poetry. We're really lucky that you have pieces in the climate issue. And I'm just excited that people are going to get to discover your poems and to be with your perspectives. So, Gurmila Maigev, thank you so much.
Thanks, Anne-Marie. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Stinging Fly podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it. Or if you're new to the podcast, please subscribe. You can support the work we do by taking out a subscription to the Stinging Fly magazine or by becoming a friend of the fly. Information on all our workshops, events and publications can be found on stingingfly.org. This episode of the Stinging Fly podcast was hosted by me, Anne-Marie Nihoran, produced by Owen Rogers and edited by Ian Malini. Thanks to the Arts Council who provide funding for this podcast and for everything else that the Stinging Fly is doing to seek out, nurture, publish and promote the very best new writers and new writing. We'll be back next month. Thanks again for listening.